So this is very much first thoughts about an issue. And the great thing about first thoughts is that I'd be delighted, as opposed to a lot of things that I write, if people told me that this was completely conceived. As a matter of fact, I'd be grateful, because it would allow me to, it would avoid my wasting a lot of time on developing a misconceived project. There's something very liberating about giving a paper on something where one doesn't feel that one has to fight for every inch of philosophical territory. Anyway, this paper is born of a question that sort of niggles at me as a Montrealer on a personal level rather than an academic level. Whenever roughly the following thing happens, Montreal is a place that gets talked about by the rest of our society a lot as posing problems for the broader society, which need to be settled by the broader society. So Montreal is a much more multicultural place than the rest of Quebec, objectively speaking, just in terms of the ethno-cultural mix. And this is seen as a problem by the decision makers in Quebec City, who think that multiculturalism, poses all kinds of problems for the social fabric. Montreal is a much more multilingual, and in particular bilingual, city than is the rest of the province, and this is seen as a problem, one that needs to be addressed and legislated from outside the city. And the question that I have as a Montrealer is, what claim do these other people have to determine how the cultural mix or the linguistic mix in Montreal is going to occur? Should Montrealers not have a certain degree of self-determination, which is greater than the self-determination which they presently enjoy? And this is sort of like an irritated newspaper reader's reaction, which doesn't necessarily give rise to good philosophy. But in this particular respect, as I started thinking about the issue, I thought, I can't really think of any good reasons to not sort of give a certain amount of credence to my newspaper reader's irritation in the morning at the way in which Montreal gets talked about as a problem that needs to be fixed from outside. So the paper is called Self-Determination for Some Cities, and the sum just simply alludes to the fact that I lay out a certain number of criteria which seem to me to justify there being a certain degree of self-determination for cities. And it could be that there's some cities that just don't satisfy the criteria. I leave that open, right? I'm thinking about it on the basis of a very, very limited empirical sort of basis, which is my acquaintanceship with Montreal, and with you think of Brussels also as a city that fits this same sort of, Brussels is a problem that needs to be addressed. Jerusalem perhaps is a problem that needs to be addressed, right? By people outside. So I'm just going to be very quick about this. So this is very much a framework rather than an argument. So the paper works in, has three main, it's going to have three main sections when I actually write it as more than just a set of sort of completely, bald statements. The first section will just do some sort of conceptual ground clearing. And the two main conceptual ground clearings that I want to do have to do with the concept of self-determination, with the concept of cities. So very important, self-determination, cities do, in fact, enjoy a certain degree of self-determination pretty much everywhere in the world, in that there are certain things that they get to decide, to do with the way contracts are given out for various public works and things like that. So there is some degree of self-determination. But for me, self-determination has to include two things. It has to include a range of issues over which a certain political entity has either exclusive or shared jurisdiction, but it also has to include what I call pompously, and I think I borrowed this from someone, I can't remember who. If somebody knows the reference, tell me, because I don't want to be accused of plagiarism. Meta-jurisdictional authority. In other words, it has to include the ability to at least participate in discussion over jurisdictional authority, namely over those issues over which the city will have either shared or exclusive jurisdiction. So it can't just be that you have sovereignty if Hoy tells me these are the things that you can decide for yourself, I still don't have meta-jurisdictional authority because those things that I get to decide are determined by Hoy. So it has to include those two things, and certainly in the context of Canada, and I'd be interested, to know from the people who know more about other places whether this is the case elsewhere, cities don't really have meta-jurisdictional authority, though they do have a certain range of jurisdictional authority. The other thing is to do with just the concept of a city, right? So I think that, it's actually a more difficult sort of conceptual issue to determine what a city is than simply looking at a map, for reasons that were quite nicely brought out by the last paper yesterday afternoon by Marie-Claude Prémont. Montreal is made up of 27, or now it's less, but it was 27, 28 municipalities. I think that ethically, the division of Montreal into 28 municipalities is indefensible, in the sense that, in the same way that when Padania, you know, the Northern League decided that there was something called Padania in Northern Italy that had a kind of nation-like status, that was morally illegitimate because the real grounds of it was just sort of stepping away from, you know, what was in fact a sort of shared national culture with the rest of Italians. In the same way, it seems to me there's something morally illegitimate about saying that people who, in fact, and this is what I think the relevant criterion should be for the determination of a city, are spatially interdependent in a certain way. So for me, the concept of a city should have to do with a sort of degree and intensity of spatial interdependence, that our spatial fates are tied in with one another. I'm not going to say more about it because I haven't really thought enough about it to come up with anything more precise, but it seems to me that the notion of a city that we should use would have to do not with the lines on a map, but with spatial interdependence. So I'll just leave it at that. So those are the two conceptual ground clearings that I wanted to sort of get clear on in the paper. And then there are the four arguments. So I divide it up into two arguments for jurisdictional authority, two arguments for meta-jurisdictional authority. Nothing original here, just sort of trying to group together things that other people have thought and make them into something a little bit perhaps more coherent. So it seems to me that there are two claims that cities can make for jurisdictional authority, which I call the ones that sort of relate to the argument from affected interests and the other one that relates to the argument from subsidiarity. What do I mean by affected interests? Well, imagine that, you know, we were to determine that in this room the just amount of energy that we would be able to use for both lighting and cooling or heating, depending on, is X, right? And we have to decide whether we're going to divide X for heating and lighting in this or that way. It seems to me that if we're not using more than our fair share, the decision as to how much we're going to use for lighting and how much we're going to use for heating should be entirely up to us, because we share space in a way which the people out there don't. So there's certain decisions that are a function of spatial interdependence, which, conditional to the fact that we don't use more resources than our fair share and thus don't affect third-party interests deleteriously, we should be able to decide on certain things for ourselves. So that's the argument from affected interests. The argument from subsidiarity says basically that people in a city are better placed. So it's an epistemic argument, as I conceive it, more than a moral argument, though it has moral implications. People in a city are better placed to determine what good policy is and how good policy should be implemented than people outside the city. And here I'm thinking very much of the recent sort of 4 or 5 year provincial trauma that we've had over multiculturalism, where I'm going to put it very crudely, you know, a lot of people who don't have daily experience with the facts of multiculturalism come to conceive of the problem of multiculturalism in a certain way, and then come to think of the solutions that multiculturalism, to the problems that multiculturalism raises in a certain way. And they are just not epistemically situated in such a way as to be able to determine either what good policy is or how it should be implemented. That there is an epistemic reason to give the people whose lives involves dealing with the plurality of cultures on a daily basis more weight, again, for epistemic reasons. So those are two arguments for jurisdictional authority, why certain things ought to be, if Hoy were the king of the universe, he ought to devolve certain amounts of... That's 20 seconds I get back. Why he ought to devolve a certain range of issues to the city. Now, the second range of arguments are for why Hoy shouldn't be the king of the universe, why there ought to be meta-jurisdictional authority. In other words, why cities should be able to determine not just what should be done about X, but what are the X's about which they should be able to at least have shared, if not exclusive, authority. Now, here there are two arguments, one of which was inspired, I should say, shameless plug for Avner and Daniel's forthcoming book on the culture of cities, which I had the good fortune of reading in manuscript form. So I want to critically borrow the idea that Daniel and Avner developed there, which we talked a little bit about yesterday in the context of Avner's paper, the idea that cities have something like an ethos. I think the term ethos lends itself to too consensual reading, but that's not what they have in mind. Call it something like cities have something like a central narrative or a central predicament, call it, which forms the backdrop against which people lead their daily lives. So I think that in certain, you know, some of the cases that Daniel and Avner discuss in the paper are really sort of well judged. I mean, as a Montrealer, if I go to a monolingual city, I feel strangely out of place. The fact of having to negotiate bilingualism on a daily basis is sort of like, I almost feel like waxing Heideggerian here, the sort of, you know, I don't know if it's an existential or an existent, it's sort of like the unspoken sort of foundation that constitutes the basis of my finding my way around in the world. That was lame, but anyway. And it seems to me that a lot of cities have something like this central predicament, which, you know, is not so much a set of shared values. I'm very, very skeptical about talk of shared values, because I think that actually people don't share that many values. But what they do share is something like a central way of organizing their existences. And in a lot of cities, that is organized around what I call, or what I'd like to think of as, a central narrative or a central predicament, which is, in important ways, identity conferring. So a lot of the talk, if you read the sort of Kimlicka literature about why certain kinds of national minorities should have group rights, one of the strands of argument, not the only one, but one of the strands of argument has to do with the importance of sort of nation or sub-nation, national minority, to identity. I think that probably a much stronger claim can be made for the importance of city to identity than the importance of nation to identity, because of its concreteness and embodied nature. I want to make a distinction between first and third person conceptions of identity, where first person conception is what, you know, what's your identity, Daniel? Oh, you know, I'm this. I could be wrong about my own identity, because somebody looking at me from the outside and interpreting my activity could be able to account perfectly well for my actions and my behavior without referring to the thing which subjectively I report as, you know, central to my identity. I think that it's a much more useful conception of identity, which is one that does explanatory work rather than one which is purely based on people's self-reportings. And I think that, and here, you know, sort of an idea that Clarissa Hayward developed in a paper I heard a couple of weeks ago in St. Louis was very, you know, the idea that cities shape identity in a sort of corporeal manner rather than a sort of an abstract sort of ideational manner is something that's very important for me. So if we think that there is something about the shaping of identity that grounds group rights, it seems to me that we have, if anything, a stronger claim to at least consider the idea that group rights should attach to civic identities than to national identities, or at least a strong an argument. The fourth argument has to do with borrowing an argument from Will Kimlicka, which has to do with the potential corrosive impact which larger external cultures have upon smaller cultures. One of the reasons why Kimlicka thinks that the Quebecois should have minority rights, or the Catalonians, is that, look, we don't have to assume that the people around us, Anglo-Canadians, Anglophones in North America in general, are nasty people hell-bent on our destruction. All we have to realize is that if majoritarian processes were allowed to proceed in a geographically undifferentiated manner, Quebecois would lose out on a lot of issues that are central to their being able to continue to live their lives as a Francophone society in North America. So I think, you know, mutatis mutandis, the same thing applies to cities for reasons that I adverted to at the very beginning of my talk, in my pre-talk, as I was telling you about my sort of reasons for thinking about this issue. It just seems to me that there are a lot of issues which, for reasons that I've already talked about, should and ought to be, are more appropriately dealt with at the city level, which risk being dealt with in ways that are insensitive to the ethos of the location by people outside, unless we grant cities a certain range of group rights. So call it the argument from corrosion. 2 minutes. Okay. In the final section of what I distributed to you, I'll just end with this. I consider certain counterarguments that one might have to the idea of cities having both jurisdictional and meta-jurisdictional authority. And the main argument, actually the only one that I had time to develop, I said that there were going to be two, and I realized that I only put in one because I ran out of time, has to do with the sort of Waltzerian idea that you can't really exercise sovereignty, you can't really exercise political authority unless you have sort of control over your membership, right? So if you can't, if there's no self to in the self-determination, right, there can't be self-determination, and there can't be a self unless the terms of membership are sort of defined by the collective entity. So I think that this is I think there are a lot of ways in which to criticize that argument. But what I want to argue is that there's a core idea at the heart of Walzer's argument, which is that not just anybody should be able to, you know, the tourist from Ithaca, you know, in Montreal for 2 days should not be able to vote on issues that concern Montrealers more durably, right? On the other hand, the people who should be able to determine, I think that we have to give pride of place in thinking about this to the idea of residency. Right, to the idea of residency. So I define residency as decisions that people make, right, through their domicile, through their work, through the way in which they engage in their leisure activities, that sort of evince a commitment to the place, a durable commitment to the place, right? So not just anybody who finds himself or herself on the territory of Montreal is a resident in this sense. So the Waltzerian concern that we shouldn't just be able to let anybody vote on our common affairs if we're going to have self-determination seems to me to be at least partly satisfied by the idea of residency. And it seems to me that the idea of residency is more morally appropriate than is the Waltzerian notion of national membership, because it satisfies to a greater degree the first principle that I talked about, which is the affected interests principle, right? Residents, be they nationals of the country in which the city is located or not, are people who are durably affected by the decisions that are taken at the city level. And so it seems to me that we have both, by giving residents the right to participate in self-determination, a more morally appropriate criterion than the Waltzerian criterion. And we also retain something of the Waltzerian pragmatic idea, which is that we have to be able to control membership or else we don't really have a self that is self-determining. So that's very, very vague. It's just, as I said, a sketch of, you know, what I'd like to develop. And hopefully you'll either tell me to sort of carry on or tell me why this is all full of a lot of hands have gone up. Tell me why this is full of you do. Thank you.
No, don't stop. That's a terrific question. You may have problems, I think, with the boundary questions. In Toronto, we used to talk about Toronto, and now we talk about Greater Toronto, and now the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area, and now the Horseshoe, stretching from Hamilton all the way to Oshawa. But the main point I want to make has to do with your conception of a city, which I really like that way of going at it. You said narrative and central predicament as if these were synonymous, but they are not synonymous. And I like the central predicament approach, and in particular, what do you think of this? Following Dewey, if you follow Dewey, you'd think of a city as a certain kind of public, and so the public and its problems. And that's one of the defining features of a public that would distinguish it from other publics, is that it has problems unique to itself. Cities are different than villages in that the problems are not the kind of things that can be solved by or resolved by face-to-face negotiation or tradition, but they're unlike nations or provinces or something. They're not, they all of them are quotidian problems. There are, of course, quotidian problems that states are involved with, bigger than cities, but all of the main problems that cities address our quotidian problems. And so that is to say, you know, how do you get people to school and transportation and water to drink and waste to be gotten rid of, all those sorts of things. So I'm not sure that the fact that an urban public, that will help you to define an urban public and also identify the problems that the public has. And because they're their problems, then all your arguments kick in that they're the ones who ought to have some special role in trying to resolve them. I'm not sure that the problems, confronting the problems, is identity conferring. I think that's a different thing. Maybe it interfaces with it, and the way that problems are resolved will differ depending upon the cultures of the culture or the aura or ethos of a city, but not necessarily, because they can also, the way the problems are solved or the fact that there are these problems at any one time might also help to shape or affect positively or negatively people's conceptions of themselves. So I'm just suggesting, I mean, I really like what you're doing, and I'm suggesting that you distinguish between narrative and predicament.
I have no, that's very helpful. And now I have to read both Henri Lefebvre and Dewey.
Okay, so I wanted to, I like the idea, I've thought a lot about affected interests in a very similar way too. And I want to suggest three possible implications of grounding the argument in affected interests, one of which I think, based on what you said, you're going to endorse, one of which you didn't endorse here, but I think if you think about it more, you will, and then a third which I think you won't endorse, but I wonder if you can say why. So the one I think you will endorse is that this argument will really decenter membership. So I think in the case of a city, you want to think about non-citizen residents. So in other words, that they ought to indeed have their standing in power relations to citizen residents, and they ought to indeed, you know, be empowered to participate, and I think you'll agree with that. I really strongly think that the that making affected interest central to your argument decenters residents. And this is an argument that Jerry Frug makes. So my interests might be very strongly affected by decisions taken in a city where I work but don't live. And he's got lots of interesting examples. There's court cases of people who like work in one place, live in another place. And I think this is my, what I think about, I don't think this comes from him, but I would say in a city where I'd like to live, but where I can't live because of exclusionary zoning. So I might want to spend my votes there rather than in the place where I live and don't want to live. So I don't think affected interest tracks residents the way you suggest. So then the one I think that you won't endorse, but I think you need to think about why, is people whose interests are affected because they're property owners. For example, like an absentee landlord. So their interests are going to be strongly affected, but I don't think you want to go all the way there, and I'm not sure why.
So the second thing is my interest affected by a place that... So, I mean, I'd want to know more. Like, if I want, I might want to live in Monte Carlo, but I can't live there because it's too expensive. The other thing is I can't live in this gated community that is... because they won't let me in. So I think that those two cases are different. It seems to me that, you know, the gated community example is like the Westmount example of yesterday. It seems to me that on my conception of city, they don't get to call themselves a different place. So, you know, sorry, you're still in the same city, right? Unless they set themselves up sort of outside the bounds of, and I recognize the boundary problem as being a fearsome one.
It's about
yeah, but... So it would depend. I'd have to know more about what it is that, how the place that I can't have access to is related to the place that I am. If it's Monte Carlo, you know, I don't really see it as a problem. If it's Westmount, you know, that decides to enact some kind of, then I don't see it as a problem for the view that I'm defending either, because we're just in the same city. You don't get to do that kind of exclusionary zoning. So people whose interests are affected but who aren't there. Yeah. So either I have to bite the bullet and let them in, or I have to sort of refine the principle. Yeah. I mean, I'm gonna want to say that, you know, all these things are, I'm very, you know, one of the professional sort of problems that philosophers have is that they are trained, or at least people in the analytic tradition, are trained to see things in very, very sort of bright red, black or whatever lines. You know, you either have an interest or you don't. You're either within the boundary or you're not. And, you know, reality is much messier in that it's all shades of gray, or there's a lot of shades of gray. So, you know, is there a place for an all affected interest that has that has a gradation of ways in which your interests are affected? So that if you live and work in a place, you know, and your daily bodily existence is wrapped up in decisions that people take about transport and you know, air quality control, et cetera, you have a greater interest than does somebody who owns property in a place, doesn't live there. But, you know, but do you want to deny that they have an interest? I probably don't want to go that far. But what I probably need to do is come up with a conception of all affected of interests that just recognizes that people have different kinds of interests that are of varying degrees of moral urgency, given what they...
Okay, there we go. So here's an example from, because I noticed you even used St. Louis in your paper. So in St. Louis, there was, fairly recently, there was a light rail system put in. And various municipalities, you know, various, you know, distances from the city could decide whether or not they would extend the light rail system. And one, you know, suburb on the outskirts decided, you know, no, we're not going to do it. So that's the end of the light rail system. So I could be somebody who lives in the central city, who works out there, and who's strongly affected by that decision. And I think just saying, well, I'm just going to then define that as a city is sort of wishing away. Like, I think that the issue is that my interests aren't so wrapped up with residents. And this is the argument that a lot of legal theorists have made, that that I can have interests that are due to working in a place, there's all kinds of reasons I could have interests in a place, right? Yeah. And they just say things like, well, there's practical solutions. Give people a certain number of votes and let them spend them where they want to spend them in municipal elections. And then they kind of decide what their interests
yeah.
are.
Yeah, no, I agree that just saying it's one city is it's not so much wishing the problem away. We had a similar problem anecdotally with Westmount, the much maligned Westmount, justly much maligned Westmount, which for 2 years blocked, you know, you may have noticed that we have this wonderful network of public bicycles, right? And the area that I live in, which is a neighborhood just beyond Westmount, was deprived of them for 2 years because Westmount didn't want them, so we were left out of the network. So, you know, part of me wants to say just plunk them down there and, you know, the hell with them. Now, what it seems to me is it raises the fact of geographical interdependence. It doesn't make it the case that we just get to say to Westmount, look, you know, forget about it. But it raises the burden of argument that they have. So in my sort of to and fro, which was, you know, at the end of the day, not very coherently put to Marie-Claude yesterday, I said, you know, we do want to weigh, you know, both the good of the greater community that is geographically integrated, but also the legitimate sense that some Westmountonians may have that they aren't just, you know, part of a larger thing, the sense of community and that sort of thing. So it doesn't seem to, I don't want to say that those considerations are evacuated by geographical integration, but it does raise the burden of argument that has to be put forward in order to block something that is, you know, on the face of it, in the greater good of the greater number.
But these were really interesting points from Frank and Clarissa. I'm not sure this is actually very interesting, but I'll throw it out just because I heard you say a really interesting way of putting the Kimlicka argument about the sort of corrosive effects of majority practices. And I guess I was just thinking, especially after Peggy's talk, if I translated the Kimlicka point thus, would you agree? It's not that capitalists, you know, are malicious and malevolent, and these, you know, big financial interests want to crush us in the city or in our neighborhood or wherever. It's just that they're big and powerful. And so this is a case for cities, as you define them, or as you sort of alter the definition as you engage with Frank's and Clarissa's points. That's why we should have considerable economic autonomy in terms of, you know, sort of setting price levels, all kinds of economic regulations, and meta-jurisdictional autonomy over certain matters of fiscal and monetary policy that affect us. Is that just kind of a silly analogy that falls apart? Or if you buy this Kimlicka defense of meta-jurisdictional autonomy, do you need to give the city considerable economic meta-jurisdictional autonomy? Because, of course, the city is this engine of growth that's still extraordinarily impacted by national-level economic policy. And so is there this subversive...
I mean, everything I say now is going to be incredibly tentative. So the one thing that I want to insist upon is that I don't want my argument to be an argument that allows cities to divorce themselves from the fate of others with whom they're also implicated. Again, I think that the fact that we have special interests that bind us together because of our spatial interdependence does not mean that the ties that bind us to the larger say national or even international community disappear. Somebody used the idea yesterday of virtual community as opposed to when I gave my little philosopher's example of, you know, us in the room getting to decide, you know, I was at pains to say conditional upon our use of resources being fair to people outside. So if we're just using our fair share of resources, then we get to decide what we do with that fair share of resources. So it's important to me that condition be highlighted. So in terms of economic policy, I think it would have that implication. You know, capitalists and majoritarian process look the same to communities that are trying to keep a certain way of life going, in that they are these big sort of steamroller type things that you don't have to impute malevolence to. It's just, you know, power, right? Sorry?
Yeah.
Just power. And you have to have ways in which to check power. Now, part of that is going to have to be the nature of the economic beast is that part of the power that you're going to have to use to check that is going to have to be economic power. But I want it, you know, and I haven't thought about these issues enough to say anything more than just simply that. Whereas it seems to me that you can have exclusive jurisdiction over certain issues where spatial relations are, you know, whether we use Bixies or, you know, it doesn't matter to somebody in Beauce, right? But the way in which we arrogate economic power to ourselves might have an impact on. So there's an area where, you know, at first blush, I want to say it sounds to me more like a case for shared as opposed to, you know, exclusive jurisdiction, because you want to be able to check the impacts of cities taking on more economic policy prerogative on the broader community. But yeah, I mean, I don't see any argument a priori to restrict the Kimlicka argument purely to majoritarian processes.
I just thought that your arguments raised issues about metropolitan governance. Some people have mentioned some points, but one is the fact that interdependency is not something that will necessarily be obvious either from a first-person or third-person perspective for suburbanites. I can very well imagine that people who live in Blainville or Saint-Julie or Vaudreuil have this view of themselves as not being dependent upon the core city. And this raises questions of should Montreal have a say as to what goes on outside of its boundaries, but not jurisdictionally speaking, but territorially speaking, because in fact, you could argue that it affects, you know, what goes on in the region affects it, but whether what goes on in Montreal affects people living in those other places is a really important one, especially in this case, because as you know, a lot of Francophones leave the island and go isolate themselves in these suburbs precisely for the reasons that you mentioned, because it's multiculturalism is perceived as something problematic. So I was just thinking, in terms of the recent regional plan that was just, adopted a few days ago, you know, it's really interesting to see all the mayors from a lot of the suburbs in the Couronne Nord, in the sort of northern region, being strongly opposed to having this will imposed upon them by the central, you know, the central city and suburbs. And so, you know, this question of where does interdependency begin and stop, I think, is a really important one.
I mean, there are two questions there. One is the one that you just summed up, the, you know, where does it begin and stop? And I think that, unfortunately, it doesn't have a nice clear red line, right? There's probably a point at which, you know, as you go north past Blainville, Mirabel, whatever, you come to a point where you can say, okay, you know, there's still connections, but they are the same sorts of connections that we have within nation states. You know, they're virtual connections as opposed to, but where that happens, I have no idea. You know, there's no exact, you know. Now, the other question has to do with levers, right? So I don't know the regional plan, and I should probably, if I'm going to talk about these things intelligently, read it. But it seems to me that one can act on things over which one has uncontested jurisdiction, which will have an impact, and I think an impact which is legitimate on the way in which other people who are arguably outside will live their lives. So, for example, you know, when Ken Livingstone came to power in London with, you know, I mean, the mayor of London doesn't have a great deal of jurisdictional autonomy, right? A lot of people until Ken Livingstone thought that it was largely a decorative function, you know, wear silly hats twice a year and, you know, for various civic ceremonies. But, you know, he imposed a tax on cars coming into London, right, which had an impact on the ability of people who live outside to, you know, to be able to live with London on their own terms rather than on terms that are fair to Londoners as well. And it seems to me that, you know, that isn't really interfering in the affairs of some Essex county, you know, an hour outside London. It is very much sort of using a lever which falls well, you know, and nobody could contest, you know, the right of Londoners to determine the terms upon which people will be able to use cars within the city limits, and yet it'll have an impact. So that might be, I mean, I think that the best scenario is a sort of a deliberative one, is where we manage to show to people just how interdependent our fates are geographically and spatially, despite first appearances. Look, I left for Blainville precisely to escape this geographic interdependence with people that I don't, you know, necessarily want to deal with. Well, look, the fact is that you haven't, and here's why, right? Here's why your way of life still imposes externalities, you know, that haven't been even, forget about compensated, even been recognized on people who live in the island. So that's the ideal thing. But it seems to me that non-ideal, you can still use levers that are sort of, you know, unquestionably, right? We'll probably have a discussion over coffee about that, but I think I want to divide the question into the sort of instrumental one and the principled one.
So I agree with all of what you're saying. I think that there may be some details we may quibble about, but there's also, I think, an interesting methodological division, the political theory, political philosophy division, that in terms of how this is structured. But there is one thing that I'm not clear about. It seems that spatial interdependence is the criterion for determining what counts as a city and what doesn't. But the cities that you seem to be most interested in, seem to have another dimension, which is a more, I mean, to call it by a conservative name, a traditional dimension. That is that they have a notion of self-identity cultivated through long practice that is not exclusively bound up with simple spatial interdependence. So, you know, your mother-in-law, for instance, and the notion of Westmount, which, regardless of its spatial interdependence, has a narrative which is distinct from that of Montreal. And in fact, the narrative is dependent on being distinct from that of Montreal. I wonder what place long practice, tradition, and identity shaped through time would have as a different factor, as a mitigating factor, as something that simply complicates things. And maybe suggest a Rawlsian interpretation of the jurisdictional issue. It seems that there are spheres of basic structure, to like do a mashup of Walter and Rawls. What counts as a basic structure at one level may be, and subject to justice at one level, say the local level, may be something more like an association at a different level. One way of interpreting what you're saying is that cities, at least at the provincial level, cities are like associations that are without being part of the basic structure.
Yeah. So I'm not going to necessarily use the basic structure argument, but I want to acknowledge something that you said, which is that, first of all, the reason why the paper is called Self-Determination for Some Cities is that it could be that there are some city, other, you know, there's some cities where jurisdictional autonomy is fine, where saying, look, you know, for reasons of subsidiarity and the affected principle, the all-affected principle that I invoked, look, you know, we're going to give you jurisdiction over this, that, and the other thing because it just makes sense that we do. But you know what? You don't constitute a sort of subject in the sense of having some kind of constitutive predicament or whatever, such that we think it's important to give you meta-jurisdictional authority. I, at least in principle, somebody mentioned Cleveland yesterday in some context. I've never been to Cleveland, so I don't want to, I mean, you know, it might be a complete, you know, Cleveland might be a fascinating place with a, you know, sort of deep, rich, constitutive narrative, but it could be that there are places that don't. Now, the thing about, and I want to leave open that possibility, that's the sum. So, you know, I'm a pluralist in a deep sense, and so, you know, I don't think that the geographical interdependence thing is the only criterion, the knockdown criterion that evacuates all other considerations. And this goes back to an exchange that I just had a minute ago with Clarissa. You know, I think that there are other considerations to do with tradition and community that might make it the case that considerations of justice born of this criterion of spatial interdependence have to be tempered by considerations of tradition. I think there's a lot of in what Peggy was saying in her paper, because, you know, as much as cities might have sort of central predicaments, neighborhoods might as well. There might be something about being an NDG-er or you know, somebody who lives in the area that Peggy lives in that needs to be given some weight too in this consideration, in this range of issues. So, you know, I think I'm enough of an egalitarian to think that it's not that justice considerations born of spatial independence trump everything, but to return to a very vague and evasive thing that I said to, I think, Clarissa, and that just is just going to have to do for the time being, it raises the stakes for those who would invoke, say, a tradition-based argument in order to deflect a justice-based argument. It doesn't make it go away, right? It just, you know, tradition, at the very least, tradition-based arguments don't get a free ride over justice-based arguments. And it seems to me that they would have to, you'd have to make a much stronger case for why, you know, Bixies can't go into Westmount in order to respect some kind of, you know, non-bicycle element of the Westmount tradition. The burden of argument is just raised by the presence of justice-based considerations born of spatial interdependence. That's unsatisfactory.
Thanks. It's an excellent paper, and it's, I think, spot on in a number of ways. And I wanted to just throw some things at you so that you can relentlessly mine. We can talk more about it later. First thing is that the corporalness and the embodiedness of identity is something that was tackled by the people who did work on place attachment beginning in the 70s, and actually in response to Yifu Tuan on Topophilia, who said, you can have a self-identity which is linked to a place even if you don't have a long connection to that place. They were rejecting the hegemonic quality of Yifu Tuan's argument. And so Proshansky, in particular, someone wrote a paper in 78 called The City and Self-Identity, which very explicitly says self-identity is formed by being in the city and having a
and partaking in some way of the central predicament of it. I can send you the references later. I've done quite a bit of work on this because I wanted to bring your attention to a couple of really interesting cases. Swiss communes, it goes to Clarissa's comment, if you are not Swiss born, you have to live in the same commune for 10 years usually to gain citizenship. You cannot leave that place. That is what qualifies you for citizenship. And then I think there's another vote that takes place. It's sort of like the old private clubs. And then Åland, which is a Swedish-speaking province of Finland, has actually instituted a thing called, it's Hembygdsrätt, which is homeland right. You can only own property if you are a local person because it's a high amenity setting where people own second homes. So this is the main thing I wanted to say. Multiple residency throws a spanner into the works in a lot of ways because how do you create a graded kind of citizenship or residency? And multiple residency is something I've done, I've published a swath of stuff on, and so I think it's really fascinating. The Austrian census 1981 is what I would draw your attention to. People could choose which place. If they owned a second home, they could choose which place is their primary dwelling. And then government funding would be allocated to the local municipalities based on that. Vienna lost most of its population because the amenity settings where people had second homes said, if you register yourself as living in this jurisdiction, then we can improve all your services. It creates a compound problem in Ontario and Quebec, especially because we've got hundreds of thousands of households with second homes, and they pay taxes, but they don't have voting rights, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that where this is really interesting is there's a lot of pressure for how do we actually give status to people who are partaking of the place in some long-term transactional way, which is not monetized necessarily, but who are very engaged with the place. So right. I think that that's a really fascinating dimension to
right,
explore.
Right. I just didn't get to that 1980.
No, it's okay. It's just, this is, I think, the springboard that I'm seeing, it's exciting for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, it's great. And I mean, those names were all long and complicated. Please do, because I'd love to get those references. Yeah, the multiple residency thing, I mean, here's a completely unimplementable sort of philosophers. So everybody gets one vote. Right. But it's divided up and the division is proportional to the actual. Right. So if you have, you know, if you own a house somewhere that you spend, you know, 20 days a year in, then your vote in that place is, again, unimplementable, but it gives you the sort of moral principle that would allow you to not engage in the kind of dichotomous. Either you have an interest and it's a full interest and it's exactly the same as everybody else, or you have none and you have no say. But I'd love to see all that literature. It sounds like exactly the sort of stuff I should be reading.
So very quickly, Daniel, I'm sympathetic to the project. I think it's really interesting. I would note sort of four difficulties. The one that we've talked a lot about is externalities and the definition and spillover effects and that insiders and outsiders. But there are three others that haven't been mentioned. The first is just the claim that the city government city governors will govern poorly. This is John Stuart Mill's argument that they just because they don't have the knowledge or the expertise, or they are so self-interested that they'll be corrupt. So there's just a claim of competence. The third, so this is externalities, poor governors. The third is that they're more likely to oppress, that a majority will more likely be able to assemble in a smaller scale government or polity and will be more likely to oppress internally. This is basically Madison in Federalist 10, where he says, extend the sphere instead, and then Congress, there won't be factions that will be able to join up, so they're more likely to press. And then the fourth is that it's anti-democratic. This was the argument against city power in the 18th century in the United States and into the 19th century, which is that these are all having corporate entities that are not responsive to the legislature. In that case, it was state legislatures, could be Congress or whatever the national polity is contrary to sort of one person, one vote kinds of ideas, or essentially republicanism. Those are tough, and so it raises some hard questions.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I mean, the thing about city governors will govern poorly, there may be some sort of more intrinsic reason why city governors would be more likely to govern poorly than provincial or state governors. But I mean, certainly if you look at what happens in, there's a kind of a vicious circle that we find itself in, where the stakes in municipal governance are so low that people of quality don't really, you know, if you're somebody who who, you know, has ambition and you're going to try to run for provincial, or, and if, you know, if you just want to make a few bucks and, you know, play brown envelope games with your buddies, then you'll go into municipal politics. And there's no, and people aren't interested. The voting rate in municipal elections in Montreal is what, like 2% or something, 20% or 25%. It's maybe 25-30%. So there's no, you know, the population isn't interested. People who are, you know, potentially good people, you know, good people aren't interested. And so there's a vicious circle that, but it seems to me that if you invested city governance with more responsibilities, you might break out of that cycle. More likely to oppress. I mean, I'm not saying that sovereignty or autonomy is. This is not a secessionist claim. This is a self-determination claim within. You know, this is how. This is the way that we think about how to make you know, sub-state nationalism compatible with there not being 4,000 states in the world. Right? You integrate units that it makes sense to give some degree of self-determination into larger entities that include things like constitutions. Right? I mean, this is not an argument to exempt Montreal from the Charter of Rights. You know, the thing about anti-democratic, I really have to think. More about, it seems to me to beg the question, beg the question by saying the natural locus of democratic self-governance is the nation state. And relative to that, all other forms of self-governance are democratically lacking because they don't. And I need to hear more of an argument for that. I mean, part of this paper is sort of stepping back from the kind of, you know, unargued 300-year romance of the nation state that we've had, where the nation states and things that look like nation states, either at the sub-state or at the supra-state level, get to be, you know, the name of the game. You know, I at least want to re-question that argument. It could be that there are good arguments for reaffirming that orthodoxy, but certainly not the fact that it's an orthodoxy. So there seems to me to be something, at least at first glance, question-begging about saying that there's something anti-democratic about municipal governance that you don't find at provincial or federal governance. I'll just end with one sentence, which is that, you know, what I said a couple of times in answer to questions in my presentation, you know, I think that any form of governance that, you know, tries to determine within what should be done for this group of people should always be alert and alive to the costs which decisions made internally impose upon others. And there are issues of justice there as well, which I don't want to deny at all.
Great. And that's time.
Yeah. Thank you.